What I'm going to talk about today is sort of maybe three phases of what we sort of see happening with agriculture on the steppe in Kazakhstan. Sort of a first phase in the 1880s and 90s that I focus on agricultural schools. A second phase is sort of a, you know, classic, in some ways, triumph of the expert story beginning around 1907. And then right before the First World War, we see really a ramping up of this apparatus, this agricultural apparatus that's really beginning to do things in the steppe, albeit never exactly what it plans to do. There's a lot of failure in this and a lot of recalibration going on, and that's sort of where I am toying around with this title, to kind of juxtapose. On the one hand, this is a real process that's happening, that the power of the Russian Empire is growing in the steppe, especially with regard to agronomy and agriculture. But at the same time, it's, you know, the agronomists themselves' ideas are constantly getting shifted around. To give you an idea of what we're talking about, this is you know, modern day Kazakhstan. You can sort of see the map of Kazakhstan sort of superimposed on these main regions of the steppe. I'll be talking about the ones on the north, which it, for the most of this story are part of what's called the Governor Generalship of the steppe, which is a military occupation of the steppe. That is a, you know, officers who are in charge of it. And sometimes this corner down here where you see in purple the Verni and Bishkek, on this dark purple bit in the corner is also sometimes part of the Governor Generalship as well. But what I'm really interested in is, you know, agronomists and all kinds of scientists love to talk a good game about how backwards indigenous knowledge or people are, and their agriculture especially. And so what I'm interested in is what happens when they get the chance to actually plant things in the dirt. How well does this work out for them when they're the ones doing it and they can't sort of blame anyone else? And, you know, the reality, as we'll see, is somewhat predictable for those of us who study these kinds of things. To sort of kick things off, just to give you a little bit of background, sort of the way Russia gets involved in this steppe is somewhat complicated and a long history, and I won't bore you with it. But there's sort of a first phase of really military occupation that comes with Cossack settlers, right? These are the fiddler on the roof, bad guys, not Kazakhs, who are basically Russian. They're certainly Russian-speaking. They do some farming, but as we'll see, it's not always the type of farming that the authorities would like to see. But beginning in the 1890s, and then very much speeding up after the reforms of 1906 and 7, we see hundreds of thousands of ethnic Russian settlers coming into the steppe. Actually, many of them are from this, sort of have given up their farms in New Russia that you heard about this morning, and are moving into the steppe. Some of them are also Germans. Mennonites play an important role in this. So we have these Russian settlers coming in, occupying these lands that, you know, imperial officials are saying are wastelands, right? Because the Kazakhs, being nomads, aren't really utilizing them in the minds of the authorities. As we'll see, they are actually utilizing them. And so, you know, sort of a story that we see time and again, they keep taking land away and giving it to Russian peasant settlers. So I want to start with sort of what I think is a pretty telling story. In 1907, the chief agronomist of this Governor Generalship of the steppe is given the job of making an inspection tour of all nine agricultural schools across the whole steppe, and he travels almost 4,000 miles on this trip, and he sees a wide array of things. There's some successes maybe in his eyes and a whole lot of failures, you know, buildings in shambles in one school and really nice buildings in another, sort of non-existent farms in one place and beautiful crops in others, and even one farm that he says exists only on paper. When he comes to the school in Atbasar, which is sort of near modern-day Astana, the current capital of Kazakhstan, he walks out into the fields and he sees this this patch of weeds where there's supposed to be a wheat field, and the there's a student standing there, and he's kind of, you know, shaking his head at this weed patch, thinking, why isn't there a wheat field here? And the student sort of, you know, reads into this, and he says, you know, well, what are we supposed to do if they teach us one way in the classroom, and in the fields they do things entirely differently? And that, I think, really is the question in this story. Christoforich doesn't have an answer, really, to this question, but it really shows the challenge that he's got. Because on the one hand, these schools are sort of supposed to be, you know, just very simply taking the best of Russian Western agricultural knowledge and plopping them down on the steppe. But the reality is that that's not exactly the way it can work. But even before this 1907 experience, Russian knowledge, even in 1907, Russian knowledge of the steppe is still quite limited. It's a huge area that we're talking about. And so when these schools are first established in the 1880s, you know, Russian imperial knowledge about the steppe is even more limited. And so what ends up happening is these schools, which most historians and people at the time think of as failures and perhaps somewhat insignificant, which they are maybe as educational institutions, actually end up playing kind of an interesting role with regard to this knowledge creation and knowledge gathering on the steppe. And a chance for Russian agronomists to get a chance to actually plant things and see how well they grow. So what we end up seeing, though, is, you know, this wasn't the case. So in addition to trying to remake this environment, you're also trying to remake a people, right? You know, the hope is that these nomads will take up sedentary farming with best Western practices and, you know, all become good farmers and sort of bring the steppe into part of the economy of the Russian Empire and sort of generate wealth for a relatively poor country in terms of capital, at least. And so a lot of the schools that Christoforovich inspects in 1907 weren't started as early as the first ones were. But the first ones were actually Kazakh schools. And so we see an interesting development here, because the idea is that we're going to open these schools so that all the Kazakh boys, they're only boys allowed to go to these, can come and learn how to be good farmers. And the first one of these is opened in Zaysan, which is in the far, far corner just south of that lake that you can see there, almost on the border with China, which is opened in 1887. And the stated purpose of this school and all the other schools was, there's not much to it. It just said, quote, the dissemination of agricultural knowledge among the Kyrgyz population, the Russians misnamed the Kazakhs at this point because of the similarity to the word Cossack, so among the Kazakh population. The class is supposed to take 2 years. You're supposed to have a chance of a supplementary year, either at the beginning, if you don't have very good Russian, or at the end, if you're kind of a really good student, and is open to any Kazakh boy of good health between age 10 and 18 years old, and they get quite fuzzy on that. The schools are supposed to do this with a mix of what they call practical instruction, but also theoretical learning. The practical, which takes place, of course, on the school's farm in the summer months. Students, you know, are expected to sort of work and learn how to use farm machinery and modern practices, whatever that means. The theoretical learning is supposed to take place in a regular classroom and includes really rudimentary subjects. Arithmetic is one of the big things, and Russian language. In a lot of ways, what actually happened was these schools already existed in European Russia. They'd been started by agronomists in sort of the region around Moscow, and they don't really change them very much when they stick them in the middle of the steppe. So if these questions of, you know, Russians' ideas about colonizing itself, right, or needing to civilize itself, right, they're using the exact same institutions to do both sort of this internal colonization work as well as this external colonization work. The other interesting thing about the Kazakh schools is they're supposed to be supported monetarily by local Kazakh organizations. Whether the Kazakhs have any say in this, whether they have to pay for this or not, is unclear. I haven't found the answer to that yet. And so they sort of go forward under this rough format that's really similar to the schools in European Russia. You know, so on the one hand, we have these schools which we should think about as this sort of you know, way of using science to transform, right? The people behind this really believe in science's power to transform the steppe. But interestingly, they you know, recognize the need for both this really practical education in farming, but also theoretical, but they still maintain a really strict separation between the two of them. Theory happens in the classroom, they're physically separated, and they're also sort of separated in the minds of the Kazakh students, as we can see, because, you know, things like theory and Russian language are taught in the classroom. And so what happens is students and their parents really don't pay much attention to the practical side of farming. Rather, they begin to view these schools, you know, as a way to gain some experience with Russian language, more or less. And then they can take this training, this free training in Russian, and go and do another job that probably pays better than trying to set up shop as a small farmer on the middle of the steppe, whether you're being a horse trader or an interpreter for guides or any of these types of things. So it's also clear from these schools that they're never really supposed to create scientists. You know, there's an assumption about sort of what the limits of the need for knowledge are in terms of the depth of this knowledge. And that means that even if Kazakh students had wanted to, they're not really able to fully embrace this sort of scientific approach to farming, because to the way it's taught and the way sort of everything is taught is really through these rote memorization type ideas. The fact that farming requires a lot of recalibration isn't exactly going to work. So, you know, we have these schools set up that are supposed to sort of be this this training ground for Kazakh students to come in and see, wow, this is amazing, and I should become a farmer too. And they're not exactly doing that. I mean, the reality is there's a good deal of resistance to this idea, most of the Kazakh students don't complete their term at Zaysan. They stay for 1 year or maybe two. But also we see a whole lot of complaints about the Kazakh students in the reports back. They're constantly being disciplined, and you know, the alienation that is probably going on in these classrooms is you know, being told your whole way of life is backwards and no longer needed, and historically you know, a thing of the past, is not exactly the way to like get students on their best behavior. So because of this resistance coming from the Kazakh students and their parents, already in 1890, so this is 2 or 3 years after Zaysan has opened, they're already beginning to admit Cossack children into these schools alongside the Kazakh boys. They say that this is going to be good for both groups, because the Kazakh children are going to benefit from the Russian language skills of the Cossack students, but also the agricultural knowledge among the Cossacks was, quote, no less necessary. The training in agricultural knowledge was no less necessary than for the Kazakhs, right? So there's some problems with these Cossacks as somewhat backward farmers in the minds of the authorities. And within another 2 years, they're admitting Russian students as well. Within a year or two after that, Kazakh students are actually a minority in these schools, and they no longer call them Kazakh agricultural schools. So, but the way these schools are supposed to work, you know, with making pupils and sending them out into the world, isn't of course exactly how it works. And it's also very quickly the officials of these schools begin to see that perhaps there's other ways to get to this mission of spreading agricultural knowledge, and they begin to really focus on the farm that each school has as a way to try and do this. So to do this, though, you have to have a farm that works, and that turns out to be somewhat of a problem, because the steppe can be, you know, somewhat variable. One day it may look like this, and then the next day it may look like this, right, depending on the amount of rain and the weather. So one of the first missions of setting up Zaisan School is to set up a school, or just to set up the farm along with the school itself. And the school building is in the town of Zaisan, and they can't find a place to have the farm anywhere actually near to the school building. So they end up building the farm, or setting up the farm about 12 miles away. And this distance really becomes really a constant source of complaint by school administrators as well as officials. So in the first year, they secure this piece of land, and then in the first summer, they really try and get it turned into a functioning farm. This farm, this piece of land, is about 200 acres in area, and in the first year, they plant about 15 acres of it in grain and vegetable crops, which include several different varieties of wheat and buckwheat and corn, and they explicitly plant these with the idea that they're going to figure out which grains are going to be most suitable for cultivation in this environment, the climatic and soil conditions of the given locality. So the school utilizes this information on its own, but they're also sending this back to the Governor Generalship, which is based in the town of Omsk. And especially in the 1880s and 90s, the agronomy arm of this vast Governor Generalship is quite tiny. Maybe three people is who we're talking about. So they become a really important source of sort of knowledge, but also there's a lot of expeditions that are traveling through the steppe. But what the schools give is a single spot where you can kind of trace changes over time or not changes over time that is going to be really important. And eventually this story leads to things like anti-locust campaigns in the years before World War I, at which point the schools serve as this kind of early warning system in a lot of ways for locusts and effective means of fighting against them, or not effective ones. So while the purpose of the farm is in a lot of ways to try and figure out what foreign crops, right, these crops from Russia, wheat, and their varieties from Russia too, potatoes grow well in this environment, it also is planting a lot of local crops. Varieties of alfalfa and millet are also sown as well and reported back on them. And so we have an interesting question. This isn't really an importation then. Also, the livestock that is going to manure the fields and supply the horsepower, the literal horsepower to make these farms work, is all local Kazakh breeds, in spite of the best efforts of Russian authorities to get sort of purebred strains of animals into this. But most significantly, while the crops are sometimes imports and the machinery used is often from Russia, the methods of cultivation, it turns out, are actually incredibly local. As I said before, school officials are unhappy that this farm is not in the same place as the school. This we can actually look at, and in some ways, as an adaptation of nomadization, right? In the winter, you live in one place, and in the summer, you migrate to another. And you do this because it's really cold there in the winter, quite honestly. Zaisan's not alone in this. Several of the agricultural schools are migrating because they don't have a spot in town to grow. And actually, the Bishkek school, actually in the summer months, students and teachers, the vast majority of whom are ethnic Russians at this point, are actually living in yurts on the property of the school farm. So this, nomadism that is existing at a school that's supposed to try and encourage the adoption of sedentary agriculture, is a very ironic, I think, adaptation of these Russian-trained agronomists. But even maybe this association of sedentary agriculture with Russia and nomadism with the Kazakhs is, I think, too simple. It's easy to overlook, but as we talked about this morning, there's a problem in assuming that this is, underutilized land or virgin land that exists. The farm itself actually was occupying lands that were used by Kazakhs for sedentary agriculture at Zaisan. School officials admitted this in their report. They said that it had been farmed by previous Kazakh proprietors who had moved to China 5 years before. And they said that this is because the Kazakhs were such bad farmers they couldn't manage to get a good crop. But when following the story of this experimental farm forward, we find that basically every year the agronomists the school runs, they have a major crop failure, usually more than one. And the reason for this is because the earlier Cossack settlers are stealing all of their water, which is something that was probably happening to the Kazakhs too, and this is why they ended up giving up on the spot and moving to China. even the irrigation network that the Russians established at the site of the farm, that's really very rudimentary, sounds exactly like what indigenous Kazakh agricultural practices would have been, a simple sort of earthen and stick dam at one end of the stream to sort of fill up the gully with brush swales coming off of it is basically what the Russians construct, and this is precisely the type of things that the Kazakhs did as well. So what we see then is, you know, there's a need for these schools to be successful, so they have to make these types of adaptations to this steppe environment, so that then they can try and use them as ways of showcasing these crops and these practices to locals. The interesting thing is that even though they put the stamp on them and say that this is now science, this is now agronomy, even though the dam looked exactly the same when the Kazakhs built it, you know, it's sort of giving them a power that they probably shouldn't have, right? And it's a really fictive distinction and problematic. You know, what happens is that then these schools begin some similar practices to what we saw in the Crimea. They begin to try and import new varieties, especially of fruit trees. They're very interested in fruit trees as well, and grapes for wine, and try and establish these orchards. The head of the school, a man named Srenko, he really gets into this idea of establishing an orchard. He also really gets into the idea of distributing potatoes to the local Kazakhs to free, with the idea that then they will grow potatoes. He thinks they don't grow them. They may or they may not have. But he doesn't want to just have a spot where the good way of farming is demonstrated. He actually wants to figure out a way to disseminate this a lot more. So what he does is he actually proposes that Kazakh graduates of the school are going to be given plots of land near to their home villages, these farms of 8 to 10 acres, which he calls exemplary peasant farms, are going to serve to work, are going to spread the work of the school as well, and just by their very example will convince Kazakhs of the this better method of growing. The problem is he has to have successful Kazakh graduates, which he doesn't really have. He also has to have successful agricultural methods, which, try as he might, he doesn't really get his hands on. Because of this, and a whole lot of other reasons, mostly the funding issue really sort of plagues these schools constantly, especially when they're only for Kazakhs. By 1907, a bunch of agronomists, who are now maybe 4 or 5, begin to realize that these schools really aren't the most efficient use of this money. They see that there's 50,000 rubles being spent a year on them, and they begin to calculate, and they think, well, we could hire 12 local agronomists, you know, 12 of our best friends from Petersburg, and bring them into this step. And sort of this is where we really see a change in their new approach to trying to build up the kind of, you know, typical scientific agronomic infrastructure with local agronomists, laboratories being established, papers being printed, you know, traveling. When the Russian peasant settlers are coming in, they begin to put lecturers on the train so that on the, you know, 4-day trip from Saratov, you have someone to listen to who tells you about all these wonderful new varieties of wheat that you can be growing, and begin to then simply mimic a lot of the practices and the ideas that really they'd already thought of before with the agricultural schools, but this time with money behind it. And I think one of the big reasons for this change that we see why there's so much more money behind it is because of the people in this picture. Now there are Russians, ethnic Russians, whatever that means, on the line, and we need to make sure that they don't move to the steppe and starve, pretty much. So they begin to lobby for a replacement for these schools, and this is really why in 1907 they send out Christoforovich, who's one of them. He's an agronomist too, and so sort of what he sees in the success and failures of these schools is perhaps, you know, somewhat suspect, right? It's in his own best interests to see these schools as failures and to want to have a new way forward, even if the things that they end up replicating are, you know, pretty much exactly the things that they had seen before. It doesn't hurt that a lot of the schools are a mess. There's one school that there's a dead cow in the front gate for 4 days before anyone decides to move it in the middle of a bovine tuberculosis outbreak. So there's sort of these problems going on too. So what happens is this apparatus begins to grow largely because of the increased importance of Russian settlers, and so when there are these challenges that begin to develop in the couple of years before the First World War, bad weather, famine, locusts is the big one, that infrastructure is kind of there, beginning to be there, and this is what really is brought to bear against these new enemies, and this sort of new, to sort of maybe on the versions of what some who work on Saudi Arabia have called, you know, a nascent frontier techno-state is perhaps going on here, and maybe more than nascent, because in the anti-locust campaigns in Torgai Oblast, they're using horse-drawn sprayers to spread poison over something like 200,000, 300,000 acres to spray against locusts, just going out into the steppe, which obviously requires all of these other things that we've been talking about, right? Maps, infrastructure, and a demand. But also, connected to this campaign, we have perhaps an eerie foreshadowing of Soviet developments later on. The Governor General passes a decree that criminalizes interference with this campaign, and it criminalizes a failure to report locusts as well. So what we have is maybe in the 1880s, the 1890s, it was okay to ignore those backwards farmers who don't want to embrace this sort of science. But by the years before World War II, you have to get on board, or else you could find yourself before a judge, because now this different agricultural system really requires that we're all on board doing the same thing, which maybe has some eerie precursors to the collectivization that we see in the 1920s, 1930s. Thanks.